Welcome back to The First Jews. I'm Larry Josephson. By 1775, the American colonists had had enough of British rule. George Washington was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. In 1776, the Declaration of Independence was signed.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
When the British invaded New York in 1776, a large group of our congregants left New York rather than to live under British rule.
Rabbi Mark Angel.
Some few of our congregants remained in New York. In 1776, probably in September or October, British soldiers broke into our synagogue building and they desecrated two Torah scrolls. There were two soldiers, and we are told that afterwards the British army punished them for having done that. According to the Jewish law, when a Torah scroll is desecrated, what are you supposed to do with it?
Bury it.
And our people didn't bury it. They kept both of them. And they're displayed only from time to time. And my humble opinion is that they in their time, and as we in our time, believe that there's something very sacred about holding specifically these Torah scrolls as a symbol that we were there in the middle of the action when this country was being born.
With the coming of the revolution, many Jews make their way to Philadelphia because it remains in the hands of the patriotic forces.
Professor Jonathan Sarna.
For a time, it is the largest Jewish community in the new nation. At that time, they build a synagogue, Mikveh Israel, Refuge of Israel. It's fascinating because they build it thanks to a challenge grant, probably the first ever known in America. Chaim Solomon was a very gifted businessman, and he offers to put up considerable part of the money if the community will come up with the rest. They meet the challenge, they build the synagogue, and the Philadelphia Jewish community is off and running. It must have been very difficult for Jews living at the time of the revolution. They had done well under the British. At the same time, we know that those Jews born in America felt, as other Americans did, that the crown was oppressing them and that they were being mistreated as colonists. Some Jews did side with the British, especially in Newport, but the majority of Jews cast their lot for independence.
As many as 100 Jews may have fought against the British, a substantial number considering that there were no more than 3,000 living in the colonies at the time. Lieutenant Colonel Solomon Bush of Philadelphia was the highest-ranking Jewish officer in the Continental Army. Francis Salvador from South Carolina was the first Jew to die in the Revolution. He was also the first elected to office as a member of the Continental Congress. The best-known Jew of the American Revolution was not a soldier.
Chaim Solomon had tremendous skill at marketing the bills of the new nation, of selling its bonds. He is also, we know, very generous. He gives free loans to, later, the delegates who are meeting to write the Constitution. He's perhaps the best-known Jew of that time and a name that comes through over and over.
It may come as a surprise that there are Jewish members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, despite their reputation for being exclusive upper-class WASPs.
It's completely genealogical. If you are a descendant of someone who served in the American military during the American Revolution, you have the right to be a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. But there's no question it's today a very WASPy organization.
John Loeb is a Jewish member of the Sons of the American Revolution. His ancestor, Jacob Phillips, served in the South Carolina Infantry.
He probably just watered the horses. He had come from England and he lived in South Carolina, in Charleston. His daughter, Rebecca Phillips, married my great-great-great-great, etc. grandfather, Isaiah Moses, who produced my grandmother, Adeline Moses.
Artillery, prepare to parade the colors and render honors.
Gentlemen,
sound off.
Every year around Memorial Day, members of Sherith Israel get together at the synagogue's Chatham Square Cemetery. It's the oldest Jewish cemetery in North America. Today, it's part of New York's Chinatown. Members put flags on the graves of those who fought in the Revolution.
The first flag is always placed by Chief Warrant Officer Ed Stone.
Edward Stone has an ancestor buried here.
Haman Levy, who in the 1700s took the towers out of New York and went to Pennsylvania and joined the Philadelphia militia and came back to help defeat the British and drive them out of New York. My great-great-great, go back seven grades, grandfather.
We're now going to recite a memorial prayer for all of those who are buried in this cemetery.
The revolution ends successfully, and Jews go back to their home communities, and suddenly they're living in a new world.
Virginia, like many of the colonies before the revolution, the Episcopal Church was the established church. In 1784, right after the revolution is won, Patrick Henry, one of the heroes of independence, introduces a bill to tax everyone in Virginia for the support of Christian schools.
Historian Susan Jacoby, who studies American secularism.
But then James Madison comes along, and he writes an incredible document called The Memorial and Remonstrance, Remonstrance Against Henry's Bill. It said, "We don't need to be taxing anybody for the support of any religious schools. This is not something we want in our new America." The free thinkers in Virginia, like Madison and Jefferson, joined with the Baptists, the Quakers, dissident smaller religions, in opposing Patrick Henry's religious assessment bill, because the religious minorities didn't want any establishment at all. In 1786, Virginia passes a bill establishing really complete separation of church and state, the first state to establish complete separation of church and state in its constitution.
The Virginia Act for Establishing Religious Freedom.
Be it therefore enacted by the General Assembly that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief.
The Virginia attitude, the attitude expressed there, became the template for the federal Constitution.
No religious test shall ever be required as qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
The Massachusetts Constitution could have become the template for the federal Constitution, but it did not.
In the long run for Jews, it was crucial that Madison and Jefferson and that whole line won.
Rabbi Michael Paley.
These people are high on my list of heroes of the Jewish people, no matter what they probably actually felt about Jews. First, they didn't do it for Jews. They felt that a disestablished church would be good for religion, that religious coercion, which is what they believed was going on in England, was bad for religion, and the violent reaction against religion of the French Revolution was also bad for religion.
We cannot underestimate what a revolution the Constitution and then the Bill of Rights represented.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
The Constitution eliminated in one fell stroke the notion that religion was connected to citizenship.
Historian Hassia Diner.
The document says nothing about religion, where it says, for example, who can serve as in the Senate, in the House, as president. It's about age. For president, it's their place of birth. They have to be born in the United States. And that's all.
Oddly enough,
Susan Jacoby.
At the Constitutional Convention where they wrote the Constitution, slavery was so much the issue. There wasn't a whole lot of dispute about this. Where the absence of God was debated was at the state ratifying conventions. The religious conservatives of the 18th century were really furious. There were tirades saying that God was going to just destroy the United States for adopting a constitution without God in it. Those people lost.
The Constitution was ratified in 1788. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, was ratified in 1791. The First Amendment clearly guaranteed religious freedom.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
The two parts of the First Amendment were very crucial, but they were only limited to what Congress could do.
Massachusetts and Connecticut in their state constitutions restricted public office holding to Christians. New York, on the other hand, allowed Jews and Protestants to run for office, but not Catholics. Maryland, by contrast, which had the largest Catholic population, allowed Protestants and Catholics to run for office, but not Jews, deists, or infidels who were atheists.
The United States was the first nation ever founded without an established church. Jonathan Sarna.
Jews received their rights along with everybody else. In England, it took a Jew bill. In France, it took special legislation that was aimed at Jews. You have the Gala Parade marking the ratification of the Constitution on July the 4th, 1788. You have, according to the description, the clergy of the different Christian denominations with the rabbi of the Jews walking arm in arm. Now, for those of us who grew up in an age of interfaith, we're used to these kinds of interreligious waltzes, but nobody'd ever seen anything like it in the 18th century.
After the Constitution was ratified, President George Washington toured each state. In 1790, he came to Newport, Rhode Island.
We know that many groups in the city gathered to read addresses to George Washington. Jews, too, read an address, and the address expresses pleasure at the new government for generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunity of citizenship, thanking God for all the blessings of civil and religious liberty that Jews now enjoyed under the Constitution. George Washington receives this address, he goes back to New York, and he then writes really one of the most remarkable documents that any Jewish community has ever received.
Newport, Rhode Island, 17th August, 1790. Gentlemen, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain a grateful remembrance of the cordial welcome I experienced in my visit to Newport from all classes of citizens. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while every one shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. George Washington.
Now here is a passage for Jews in America that is of the utmost importance in terms of the thinking of the founders of our country.
Historian Susan Jacoby.
They were writing to thank him for upholding the separation of church and state. And he's saying, don't thank me. We have a system of government which doesn't require you to thank us for, quote, giving you your rights, which you enjoy just because you were men and citizens.
He knew almost better than anybody else that keeping the community together was the crucial issue of prospering America.
Rabbi Michael Paley.
I think that Washington saw the Jewish community as the most direct way to send a message to everybody that this was going to be a different kind of place.
Secularist government is really responsible for the American Jewish success story. It's not that there wasn't discrimination against Jews in employment, in housing, in education that lasted well into the 20th century. However, there was no legal structure to back it up. I'm not in any way underestimating the impact of social discrimination on Jews in this country, but we see how ultimately, without a legal structure to back it up, social discrimination is not nearly as effective as institutionalized discrimination.
By 1800, the original 23 Jews, the first in North America, had become a thriving community of 3,000. 35 years later, that number will triple. By 1900, 1 million Jews are living in the United States. Though small in number, the Jews of the colonial and revolutionary periods took part in events that would profoundly affect their history and the country's for the next three centuries.
I believe that America is really the best place, at least in diaspora, that we've ever lived. I studied the Golden Age of Spain, and I'm very impressed. But to a certain degree, America has been the most hospitable place for us. I believe that the reason comes from very early in the Puritan, maybe we'll call it prehistory, as early as 1620, when John Winthrop uses the images of Exodus to articulate what he considers the mission of America as the new Israel. We were in bondage in Europe. We're free here. Now, he's not a lover of Jews, and he would not like Jews to cloud his Massachusetts Bay Colony. But if you think of America as an Exodus-based tradition, and I think that the Puritan legacy of the country being part of that, when the Jews finally showed up and they struggled, they felt at home in a way that you cannot identify in Europe.
The ideals enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, sometimes observed in the breach, were one of the two most important reasons for the success of American Jews. The other crucial ingredient was economic opportunity. Both of these were denied to Jews in most parts of Europe. In the decades to come, the history of Jews in America takes a wholly different turn. By 1820, Jews are coming in large numbers from Central Europe. They start heading west and become peddlers and shopkeepers.
The creation of the big department stores, retail trade developments in the United States in the latter part of the 19th century are credited to many German Jews spread throughout cities.
Levi Strauss was one of a not insignificant number of young Jewish men who were electrified by the discovery of gold in California. Strauss, like many other Jews, show up fairly early on in the California gold fields. They are not out there looking for nuggets. They come looking for a different kind of gold. They realize that the miners are going to need equipment. They're going to need food. And so Strauss sees the miners are wearing out their pants because of the flimsy quality of the fabric that their clothing is made of. He imports from France the material that we now know as denim. And he comes up with the distinctive quality of putting the little rivet on the pants, and the rivets keep the seams in place.
More than 7,000 Jews fought in the Civil War, on both sides. J.A. Joel from Cleveland was a Union soldier. Here he describes celebrating a Passover Seder on the battlefield.
And about the middle of the morning of the eve of Passover, a supply train arrived in camp, and to our delight, 7 barrels of matzahs were on it. We obtained 2 kegs of cider, a lamb, several chickens, and some eggs. Horseradish or parsley we could not obtain, but in lieu we found a weed whose bitterness, I apprehend, exceeded anything our forefathers enjoyed. The ceremonies were passing off very nicely until we arrived at the part where the bitter herb was to be taken. Each ate his portion when, horrors, what a scene ensued in our little congregation. The herb was very bitter and very fiery, like cayenne pepper, and excited our thirst to such a degree that we forgot the law authorizing us to drink only 4 cups, and the consequence was we drank up all the cider. Those that drank the more freely became excited, and one thought he was Moses, another Aaron, and one had the audacity to call himself Pharaoh. The consequence was a skirmish with nobody hurt. Only Moses, Aaron, and Pharaoh had to be carried to the camp, and there left in the arms of Morpheus.
In future programs, we'll hear about the 3 million Jews who emigrated from Eastern Europe from 1880 through the 1920s. Most of them settled on the Lower East Side of New York. Over time, they gave America Lox and Bagels and Woody Allen. Yiddish has enriched the American language with words like schlep and kibitz. The Lower East Side deeply influenced American popular culture. In a 2-hour program about Tin Pan Alley in Hollywood, we'll hear about Jewish songwriters like Irving Berlin, think White Christmas, and movie moguls like Louis B. Mayer, who created Hollywood. They distilled and reinforced the American myth, an idealized version of Protestant America.
I put together a list of all the major moguls who got Hollywood started. They all came from within 500 miles of each other in Eastern Europe, all came to America within 5 years of each other, and they all made the leap at the same time to get into the movie business.
Every girl, a handsome looker, had a dance with Mr. Zucker.
My name is Adolf Zucker.
I personally love Westerns, always did. The people going West, developing and struggled, it's American history, that's America.
Until recently, every American Jew has experienced anti-Semitism in some form.
It should be the duty of every citizen to demand of the sponsors of the large programs to stop feeding the public the trash of the Winchells, the Cantors, the Burns and Bernsteins, and give the American public for a change a voice which really speaks the American language without a Jewish accent.
Some people say hatred of the Jews is as old as our people. But in truth, you know, it's irrational.
We'll hear much more about this in the program No Dogs or Jews Allowed, the story of anti-Semitism in America. More than 500,000 American Jews fought in World War II. Some of them liberated Nazi death camps. Many returned not to their old city neighborhoods, but to brand new suburbs, building synagogues, and doing their part to create the post-war baby boom.
And I therefore formally declare Israel admitted to membership in the United Nations.
American Jews found a new source of unity and meaning with the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. Nineteen years later, Israel's victory in the 1967 Six-Day War filled American Jews with pride. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, Jews joined liberal political movements. Whether they realized it or not, they were following the ancient Jewish imperative, Tikkun Olam, to repair the world. Jewish college students and prominent rabbis like Abraham Joshua Heschel joined the civil rights movement to help register black voters in the South. Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner were murdered in Mississippi for following their ideals. The culture wars of the 60s and early 70s, which were driven by the anti-war movement, included many prominent Jews, like Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Betty Friedan started the second wave of feminism with her book, The Feminine Mystique.
It's a powerful, magnificent revolution. It really came to life in this country, and in my opinion, and I had something to do with it, it almost could only have happened in America.
The children of Jewish immigrants succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of their parents and grandparents in business, entertainment, politics, sports, and even crime. Think Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. But most did not become Hollywood moguls like Louis B. Mayer or a superstar like Barbra Streisand. Not a few remained poor, and some even failed. The majority led quiet lives, raising families and living in their communities. Except for blacks, who were not immigrants, they were brought to this country against their will. The American Jewish story is the story of all American immigrants, past and future.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet. Good, 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 goodbye. Good, 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 don't cry.
You've been listening to The First Jews, part of the series, Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org. Our readers were John Lithgow, Barbra Rosenblatt, and Fritz Weaver. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Parath. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund and Robert Ault. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Ault. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman-Tanner. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, to my assistant, Deborah Sitopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC Archives. Thanks also to the Ellis Island Oral History Collection, the Temament Library at NYU, the Pittsburgh Jewish Oral History Project, the DeRoe Jewish Division, and the Performing Arts Division of the New York Public Library, the Judaica Sound Archives at Florida Atlantic University Libraries, the Unite Here Archives at Cornell University, YIVO, the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project, and the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. This series is funded in part by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art.